Verses from Srimad Bhagavatam, translated by Professor K. Swaminathan. Number 63. Without the body, the world is not. Without mind, the body is not. Without knowledge, mind is not. And without being, knowledge there is none. 64. To meet the needs of various minds, the Master spoke of various doctrines. Ajata is the only doctrine he taught as from his own experience. Ajata means no birth. No birth, no sadaka, no nothing. Just the being, I guess. 141. The truth they know not who assert that power and peace are poles apart. Peace attained by inward search is what the world beholds as power. 260. Do not spread out the mind inquiring, who may you be, and who he? Turn it inward, questing steadily, keenly, who am I? 279. This must be like from Ramana Sinidhi Marai. Supposed to be like Bhagavan's teaching, she's putting in verse. Birds in the sky and fish in water dart and leave no track behind, and none can trace the path by which the sages journey to the self. I think that's an old verse, you know. I mean, they have an old Sanskrit verse like this also. Yeah. Or some, you know.
Bhagavan used old verses when they were available, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
283. Who in the golden temple of awareness installs Shiva, the form of pure awareness, and offers him the worship of awareness, his awareness is the truth supreme. And 296. Awareness is non-attachment. Awareness, purity. Awareness is propinquity to God.
That's being near.
Oh. Never saw the word before in my life.
No, thank you.
Immortality, freedom from fear, awareness is everything and all there is. A man asked the Maharshi to say something to him. One asked what he wanted to know. He said that he knew nothing and wanted to hear something from the Maharshi. Maharshi, you know that you know nothing. Find out that knowledge. That is liberation, mukti. From the Avadhut Gita, the one eternal reality exists everywhere. How then can there be any idea of unity with it or separation from it? And Plotinus, the soul in all the various forms of life is one soul, an omnipresent identity. And Eckhart, that Meister Eckhart. The now moment in which God made the first man, and the now moment in which the last man will disappear, and the now moment in which I am speaking are all one in God, in whom there is only one mouth.
That's nice.
Eckhart Tolle, you know, power of the knowledge.
Yeah.
I think that is from him. Another Eckhart. Here's the Christian view of reincarnation by Sagittarius.
I knew it.
this is Arthur Eckhart, one of his pseudonyms. He called it Arrows from a Christian Bow, number 11. Roman numeral number 11. The question that concerns Christians with regard to reincarnation is, if it is true, why didn't Christ teach it? It can be parried by the counter question, if he didn't, why did some of his early followers believe that he did? A spiritual master is apt to be an intensely practical man. He is on earth to do a job, to lead men from the unreal to the real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality, as the Upanishad puts it. Not only is elaborate doctrinal theory not essential for this, but it can be an actual distraction. Argument about theory is a facile. Let's see, facile. Alternative to spiritual effort. And by it, one can sidetrack both oneself and others. It was Buddha who flatly refused to answer theoretical questions on the ground that they would not help one to escape from suffering to enlightenment. And what mountains of subtle dialectic his followers have piled up. Christ was equally reticent. And how many of his followers have killed or imprisoned one another over points of theory that he kept silent upon and therefore obviously did not consider it important? People who know the Maharshi personally report that he too was averse to answering questions of sterile theory. I hope the mountain path will not degenerate into a forum for academic discussions of his doctrine. Got a footnote. Not as long as the present editorship continues.
He himself
said. Writing this.
Sounds funny.
Nobody knew, though, at that time. Returning to the question of Christ, he threw out hints enough for those of his followers who could understand the ultimate truth of identity, bidding them to be perfect as God is perfect, telling them that only he who lays down his life will find it, telling them that the kingdom of heaven is within them, others in plenty. But for those who could not understand heaven and hell, he said little. That there were many departments in heaven, that there would be pain and lamentation in hell, very little. But how much the theologians have spun out of it. Christ never affirmed reincarnation, but he also never denied it. So if it was implicitly assumed by the Jews of his day, his not denying it is tantamount to acceptance. And there are signs that it was. To quote from an old book, Lux Orientals, by Joseph Glanville, quote, few speculative truths are delivered in Scripture, but such as were called forth by the controversies of those times. And pre-existence was none of them, it being the constant opinion of the Jews, as appears by the question, Master, was it for this man's sin or his fathers that he was born blind. See, this is that. While they're asking. This is, okay, it's in John. You can look it up. Book of John, chapter 9, verse 1 and 4. For except they supposed that he might have sinned before he was born, the question had been senseless and impertinent. Again, when Christ asked them whom men said he was, they answered that some said John the Baptist, others Elias, others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. Which sayings of theirs suppose their belief in the metempsychosis and consequently of pre-existence.
Metempsychosis.
There one would think were very proper occasions for our Savior to have rectified his mistaken followers had their supposition been an error. Perhaps the idea has spread since Eastern doctrines began to be more widely known in the West, that acceptance of their doctrine of reincarnation would mean rejection of the traditional Christian teaching of heaven and hell. But that is not so. Hinduism and Buddhism also teach heaven and hell. No less real after death than before. But also no more. It reaps the harvest it had sown on earth in a state of heaven or hell, and then, having done so, returns again to a new life on earth to build up new karma. There is no need to go farther afield than the mountain path to substantiate this statement, since it is clearly indicated in the article by the Dalai Lama of Tibetan Buddhism, in the issue of April 1964. Now, suppose this is true. It seems a more likely supposition than that it is not true. Why didn't Christ also teach it? Why should he? For those who could understand the essential doctrine of identity, it was not necessary. For those who could not, he taught as much as was needed. That there would be a reckoning after this life. So far as hope and fear can be an incentive, that was enough to know. Those of real understanding did not need it anyway. Those who did need it would be no better off for knowing what comes later on. They would only have more to wrangle about. Some Christians, it is true, say that the Christian's belief in heaven and hell is different and cannot admit of subsequent rebirth since it applies eternal heaven and hell. It is painful to have or to have to argue about this because the very assertion of it shows such a dismal lack of understanding. Also because it does not help at all on one's spiritual pilgrimage. But having undertaken to write for a journal, one cannot always extricate oneself from barren theory. Instead of arguing, let us simply examine what this belief implies. That innumerable beings exist outside God, that God therefore is not infinite, being limited by the exclusion of them, that they are eternal, with regard to the future, but not with regard to the past, since God made them, but made them immortal. And surely it flies in the face of both reason and experience that anything should have a beginning, but not an end. And that this God, dwelling among the innumerable other beings, everlastingly rejoices some of them and torments others. And everlastingly does not mean for a million years, but everlastingly in an eternity in which a million years are no more than a snap of the fingers, without hope, without possibility of reparation, with no relief, ever, endlessly, endlessly, on account of their use of misuse of opportunities during their microscopic span of earth life. Is it necessary to say more? You know, my sister's like evangelical Christian. They believe that when you, you know, if you're not saved by accepting Christ, you're going to burn for eternity in hell. I said, how did they sleep at night? I mean, going their family. She used to send people to my mother to try to convince her. You know, my mother's a Catholic, you know. And that's not it. You know, it's not going to make it.
Even Peter was evangelical, right?
What?
Peter was also evangelical, right?
What Peter?
Peter. Wasn't he also evangelical?
You mean Paul? Yeah.
No.
You're talking the biblical?
Peter fell.
Oh no. Ah. No, from his childhood, his father was a Brahmacharian, the Ramakrishna Mission.
Okay.
For something like 5-10 years. Oh. Also, he has a PhD in mathematics and everything. He was in Hollywood. He used to take him to the Ramakrishna Mission since he was a boy.
Oh, okay.
Peter and his sister. His sister is a professor of Hindu religion or something at Plum University.
Yeah, yeah. That's how Meena, the
Sri
Kumar's wife, came to know.
Yeah, so they've been involved. Okay. His father first heard of Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi like in 1940 or something. Mm. When he was in England, his parents sent him to England to study. Then the war started there, and they went over to get him. Oh. And with his mother, he went to visit his grandmother.
Okay.
And his grandmother's friend had just come from Ramanashrama.
Wow.
And they were telling telling Peter's mother about Ramanashrama, so yeah. He knew about it. He talked about that when they had their wedding program here. Remember?
Yeah.
Far better to emulate Christ than not discussing such matters. Those who have ears to hear, as he put it, will leave aside argument and devote their lives to the struggle to be perfect, as our Father in heaven, which is within them, is perfect. For those who have not, Christ and all that was necessary when he told them that there would be a reckoning, dialogue, and discussion will not save them from it. They get scared like that. They're going to, you know, I know my sister's daughter, you know, I met her once and she, Michigan, she's going to college there, and you know, I was out there and I met her for lunch. Said, what do you think is going to happen to you when you die? She said,
I know,
okay. We were taught that in school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Everyone even in Hinduism, they frighten you like
that.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I went to a Christian school, so we had to read the Bible.
Well, I don't know, I went to Catholic school. And they didn't say that everyone's going to burn in hell for eternity. Something
like purgatory, right?
It was pretty, but they used to say only the Christians can be saved. Mm. And I remember I raised my hand and I said, what happened to all the Chinese people before Christ was born? What happened to them? And she said, sit down, don't ask questions like that.
That's
our elders in our families also. They don't have the answer, so they like to sit there. From the Katha Upanishad, the one inner self of all beings shapes itself into form, after form, and is also outside them. Well, shapes itself into form after form, and is also outside them. And a quote from Ramana Maharshi, there is only one consciousness which subsists in the waking dream and deep sleep states. In sleep there is no I. The I thought arises on waking. And when then the world appears. Where was this I in deep sleep? Was it there or was it not? It must have been there also, but not in the way that you feel now. The present is only the I thought, whereas the sleeping I is the real I. It subsists all through. It is consciousness. Article 1. Traces of reincarnation in the West. Question. Can destiny, karma, ever come to an end? Maharshi, the karmas carry the seeds of their own destruction in themselves. More philosophy, the hero of mythology.
Hero of what?
Mythology. You know, let us look briefly at the tragedy of Hamlet. An old fellow. The strange case of the Pollock twins. By Kenneth Brass. Two young girls in England have just faced a scientific attempt to prove they have returned from the dead.
Wow.
This is 1966.
Oh, yeah.
You're probably back there again. Dead. Why not? Okay. An Indian professor conducting research on reincarnation made a 7,000-mile trip to Britain after reading about the girls in an Australian newspaper. He's convinced that twins Jennifer and Gillian Pollock, age 7, oh well, that's all right, maybe, of Whiteley Bay, Northumberland, can help solve the riddle of rebirth and communication with the dead. And he tells me that he may soon visit Australia to seek more examples of reincarnation. He is Dr. Hemendra Banerjee, 38, director of the Department of Parapsychology at Rajasthan University in Jaipur, whose investigations concerning the rebirth of a girl in Saurashtra were reported in the Sunday Standard a few weeks ago. Where is Saurashtra?
Saurashtra is near Gujarat.
Gujarat.
So it's Somnath is in Saurashtra.
The girl's father, Mr. John Pollock, a 45-year-old sales supervisor, thinks they are reincarnations of his daughters, Joanna, 11, and Jacqueline, 6, who were killed by a car as they skipped hand in hand to Sunday school in 1957. The twins were born 17 months after the accident, closely resemble Joanna and Jacqueline, but most significant of all, they have similar birthmarks and can recall almost perfectly the circumstances of their sister's deaths. Gillian has a coin-sized birthmark on her hip, identical in color, size, position to one Jacqueline had. Jennifer has an 1.5-inch forehead scar identical to the one Joanna had. Yet Jennifer has never been in an accident that could have caused it. During his long interview with the girls, Dr. Banerjee talked to them about their schoolwork, games, thoughts and dreams. And he verbally reenacted the accident. All their comments were tape recorded for data processing. They had a tape recorder. You know, then it was reel to reel. Mm-hmm. Mr. Banerjee plans to return to England in May and take them to the scene of the accident to record their reaction. The girl's father said, I have never been a man to believe blindly. I always seek proof in everything. In the case of the twins, I believe we have proof beyond doubt that they are genuine cases of reincarnation. Last year, my wife and I accidentally overheard them talking about the crash that happened before they were born. They also knew how to find their way to a playground in Hanham village nearby. The other girls used to go to the playground whenever we went to Hanham. But Jennifer and Gillian had never been there before. Dr. Banerjee said the twins' case was one of the most interesting he had heard of. From the Sunday Standard. From the Ganges to the Amazon by Jean Butler. In Lima, Peru, about 20 years ago, a friend of mine who was deeply interested in psychical research came to see me one day in a state of considerable excitement. He gave me a letter to read, which had come from a priest posted in the jungles of the Amazonian region of Peru. The letter described the village where the priest lived as a tiny one consisting of about 20 mud huts and inhabited by Quechua and Aymara Indians, none of whom spoke a word of Spanish. Not only were they ignorant of the national language, but also they were ignorant of the very name of their country. They were accustomed to saying that they lived in the high place, or on the bank of the river, which, to them, was their country. In view of this, plus the fact that the priest was the only literate person in the village, there was no possibility of any fraud or deception on the part of the correspondent. There's only like two indigenous tribes still cut off from the mainstream civilization, some, you know, I think in the Andaman Islands, right? Yeah. And there's the one in South America somewhere.
Yeah, Inca tribe.
What?
Inca. I-N-C-A.
They don't try not to disturb. They made some decision, some political decision.
They're still Incas. Incas, they're there, but
most of them are Spanish mixed.
Yeah, so no,
yeah,
but there's some
real Inca.
Andaman, right?
Andaman
and Nicobar.
There's this one guy who got killed, this one preacher who tried to
shot him with balls.
His objective was to convert them to Christianity.
Yes,
you
know? That's right.
And he killed them with arrows.
Yeah.
See, Andaman and Nicobar Islands were like Australia. All the convicts, you know, they'll put them there. Because it's surrounded by sea, nobody can get out of the island. Yeah, the Inca tribe, they see all these tribal people, they have this, Priya went there for a clinic, you know, that's how I went to Peru. This lady comes and she says she has a sinus and cold and everything. She has a turban-like thing and she puts some herbs, and she thinks she's going to get cured.
Aymara couple had come to him in despair, bringing with them their small son, 7 years old. They explained that he must be possessed by an evil spirit because he claimed that he wanted to go back to his parents in Benares. On being asked where Benares was, he stated unhesitatingly, India. The parents, of course, had never heard of India, since to them their country was on the bank of the river. The priest questioned the little boy, who told him in detail that he had just remembered his home in Benares.
Wow.
He gave the name of the father and the mother, the name of the street and the description of the house. He added the information that his father was a rich Brahmin who had given him a little goat cart as a birthday present when he was 7. He was warned that he could play in the inner courtyard of the house, but was not to go out into the street. When it was getting dark, the little boy got bored with the courtyard and decided to disobey his father and try his cart out in the street. He was killed by a motor car almost immediately. On his 7th birthday in Peru, it had gradually begun to come back to him. He gave his Indian mother's maiden name and also described in great detail her appearance and even a silver necklace that she wore like a collar. The little boy kept saying over and over again that he wanted to go back to Benares. You know, Aparna's son, mm-hmm. Varun, uh-huh. when he was 4, she took him to Arunachala. Mm-hmm. And as we were driving towards the mountains, he pointed, "That's my mountain. I used to live there. I'll go. I'll show you the place and everything." He started talking about Arunachala. Wow. So, and as soon as he got to there, he said, "Come on, let's go up the mountain. I'll show you where I lived and everything like this."
Wow.
That Varun.
Yeah.
You know, he started going on talking nonstop about Arunachala when he saw the mountain. But now he denies it all. He's a college son, California. The priest, she wrote to me right afterwards, you know, she sent me an email about that. The priest was dumbfounded because he knew beyond a shadow of doubt that there was no possibility of any attempt at fraud or deception on the part of such a simple, illiterate, and primitive people. He wrote at once to my friend asking that he make an investigation in the case. My friend, Vesto, a lawyer, who wrote to the municipal authorities of Benares asking for information about the Brahmin family the boy described, also asking the maiden name of the Brahmin's wife and the number of children they had, both living and dead. He stated that he would like to get in contact with them in order to give them information about a matter which would be of great interest to them. Several months went by and we were packing up to leave Peru for good when one morning our friend came rushing in with a letter from Benares stating that the Brahmin and his wife had been located, that they were living in the same house and had several living children, but the oldest son had been killed by a motor car on his 7th birthday. All the other details, including the mother's maiden name, were exactly as the boy had described them. About a week later, we left the country for good, and I've never heard the end of the story, although an account of it was published in one of the newspapers in Lima. There's no end to the story. I mean, he's going to go on again and get killed. Die again.
Go ahead.
How I Came to the Maharshi by K.K. Nambiar. How I Came to the Maharshi, I wish I knew the answer. I know I didn't go to Maharshi to seek any particular boon, nor did I go to him grief-stricken seeking solace, nor to get cured of any bodily afflictions. Perhaps it was just curiosity for anything supernatural. From my childhood, I had felt an urge to meet spiritual men, yogis and sannyasis, some of whom demonstrated extraordinary physical feats and performed so-called miracles. The earliest recollection I have is of an ochre-clad yogi who floated on water and later stood on his head and did quite a number of difficult asanas, attracting a large crowd of admirers around him. I remember clinging on to this man late in the evening until all others had left him, asking him, "Teach me some of these feats." I must have been about 10 years old then. He taught me some pranayamas and did a sort of initiation by exerting some pressure on the lids of my closed eyes by his first and middle fingers, which made me see sparkling lights on reopening of the eyes. You know, this works for anybody.
Exactly, you know? That's what I was going to say.
Later, you know, that, remember the 13-year-old boy, Bhagavan?
Yeah.
He used to do that initially.
Oh, yeah.
Later, I had opportunity to see yogis and sadhus of several types. One of them slept on a cotton rope tied to two rafters, and another slept on branches of trees, and so on. Maharshis I had only read in the Puranas of benevolent Vasishta and Vishwamitra, the hot-tempered Durvasa, and the wandering Narada, who delighted in creating some mischief or other. But when I heard of the living Maharshi whom people could go and see and talk to, I must say, I was truly skeptical. My first introduction to Maharshi was through a little green booklet, Malayalam translation of Who Am I? It was 32 years ago. I browsed through the booklet and got a general idea of the theme, which at the time did not carry much conviction to me. A few weeks later, the president of the Salem District Board, under whom I worked as an assistant engineer at that time, suggested a trip to Tirumalai to see the Maharshi, who, in outward appearance, looked a householder, ate, drank, and lived like one. From Salem, we did the journey by car. We were shown into the hall where Maharshi reclined on the couch. We prostrated before him and sat down on the floor at some distance. No words passed between us, but I felt an indefinable sense of peace in his presence. My skepticism gave place to a sense of awe and reverence. I might have sat there for about an hour, perhaps, and wanted to bask in his presence longer. But on a sign given by my boss, I had to get up and prepare to leave the ashram. Before doing so, I prostrated again before Maharshi and fervently prayed that I might have more opportunities to have his darshan. Opportunities I had because my brother-in-law, Dr. P.C. Nambiar, got posted to Tiruvannamalai as doctor in charge of the government hospital. My sister, Madhavi Amma, a devoted soul, used to visit the ashram quite often. And I, too, made a few visits from Dharmapuri, to which place I had got transferred by then. Where is Dharmapuri?
Dharmapuri is near Salem. It's on the way to Tiruvannamalai. Near Salem.
You know, his brother-in-law, the doctor, was against his sister going to see Rama Maharshi, and he used to give her a hard time all the time, and she wanted to buy flowers and things. And then one time he was called there to see, because he's having some dental problem. So with his boots on and everything, he walked into the hall, you know, Bhagavan sitting on the couch, said, "Open your mouth."
he said,
"The Bhagavan." The doctor, the husband of her sister. But after that, he became a devotee himself.
The Padmanabhan's wife said the same thing when he wanted to come to Ogdensburg and Weld and all that. She said, "I'm not getting involved. Everything you do, you know, don't tell me to do anything and all that." And then when the grandson came and all, he's in Calgary or something, right? When they visit, she called him and she says, "He came, but he was so detached and he wouldn't talk to us and everything."
The boy.
Padmanabhan and went away. She said, "No." He did that on his own, you know.
Oh yeah, but she was very, when we had the Kumbhabhishek.
Yeah, course. That time she did it.
And,
But she was telling me the story when he decided and all that.
She used to complain, "I don't see him anymore, he's always there, for the last year or two."
And when he visits also, he won't be very detached and everything. He was so much into it after he saw that film he was explaining,
I will finish this tomorrow. I met this K.K. Nambiar.
Photographer, right?
No. He was a chief engineer of the state of Madras.
Oh, okay.
You know, he had the biggest job there of all the engineers by the time he retired.
Yeah, they were very rich also.
I went to his house on the Yadhya River.
Oh, okay.
He saw, when he did many things for the ashram, And when Bhagavan, he was at his house when Bhagavan passed away. He showed me, his son was there and said, "Appa, look!" And he saw the star going across the sky. And he knew that was Bhagavan. And he packed his car right then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Their whole family, they drove to the ashram. Yeah.
Lot of people who saw the star said the Mahatma has gone.
Why? Bhagavan himself believed that, because I remember reading some dialogue. He's with some people outside, they're sitting outside, then a star goes across and goes, oh, some great soul must have passed. Bhagavan himself said that.
A shooting star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bhagavan himself said some great soul may have passed. So